It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Today, we're looking back at 50 years of Medicaid in Pennsylvania. The law creating Medicaid was signed by President Johnson July 30th, 1965, and it has brought health coverage to children, pregnant women, people living with disabilities, and low and moderate income families in the Commonwealth and across the country. Today, we're looking at how Medicaid was created, what it is, how it's evolved, and what it might look like in the future, as well as the difference between Medicaid and Medicare. Joining us in studio is Julie Donahue. She's Associate Professor and Vice Chair for Research in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the University of Pittsburgh Graduate School of Public Health. Julie Donahue, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me, Paul.
And with us by phone from the Bay Area of California is Edwin Park. He's Vice President for Health Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Edwin Park, good to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email esspgh at wesa.fm. On Twitter at esspgh. How has Medicaid and Medicare impacted your life? Where would we be without it? 412-246-2002, the number to call. Both Medicaid and Medicare turn 50 today. Explain the difference for people who may not know what that difference is. Julie, let's start with you on that one.
So Medicare is the program for people 65 and over, as well as about 9 million people with disabilities who have long-term disabilities. Whereas Medicaid is for low-income people. And traditionally, before the Affordable Care Act, it was people who had low incomes below the federal poverty level in most cases, who also met other eligibility criteria. They had to be a pregnant woman or a child. So it wasn't for all low-income people until recently.
Edwin, what has Medicaid been? What is it today? And explain, if you would, how it's evolved over the last half century.
Sure. When Medicaid was first enacted in 1965, 50 years ago, it was primarily a program in its first decade where you could only get health coverage if you were low income and receiving cash assistance. So you were on welfare, or if you were a person with disability or you were a senior on SSI, Supplemental Security Income. And over time, that linkage between cash assistance was changed, and it became a program for low-income people, though you had to be in certain categories like children and pregnant women. But over time, the linkage between cash assistance disappeared. It became a program of various purposes, helping low-income people. Now with the Affordable Care Act, all people below the poverty line could be eligible for Medicaid, as well as a critical support for seniors and people with disabilities, helping Medicare beneficiaries with the premiums and cost sharing, and also the primary funder of long-term care in the United States.
When Medicare was up for a vote in Congress, and we heard about this quite a bit on Morning Edition this morning here on WESA, Ronald Reagan and others were making it sound like that Medicare would put us on a slippery slope to communism. When it was approved, what in fact did end up happening?
Well, I think what we can see is that the program has become, you know, the largest public insurance program. And it's a program that, even though it's government financed, for most of the beneficiaries on the program today, it's delivered through private insurance. That is, state Medicaid programs, including Pennsylvania, contract with private insurers to deliver the benefits to the millions of beneficiaries across the country.
So here in Pennsylvania, Julie, we have what as a result of Medicare?
Well, as a result of Medicaid, we have about 2.5 million people on Medicaid in the state, and Medicaid plays an important role, as Edwin said, not only for low-income people, children and adults, but also for elderly people, who most people think of as having their needs met by Medicare, the program for people 65 and older, but actually Medicaid plays a really important role in filling in some gaps left by Medicare.
Why does Medicare continue to be under attack? Jeb Bush, for example, recently declared that he's ready to phase it out, that it would still be there for people who have it now, but in the future he wants it to be gone.
Well, I think the biggest concern for both the left and the right is the long-term financing of programs like Medicare and Medicaid. These programs have seen annual increases that outpace inflation or the growth of the economy. And there's a concern that both federal and state budgets in the long term won't be able to sustain these programs.
50 years ago, doctors weren't on board with this. And since then, the support of the medical community and the AMA, which famously was not invited by President Johnson to be represented at the signing ceremony, since then, the support from the AMA has ebbed and flowed. Where do doctors stand on this today?
I think support is generally high for both Medicare and Medicaid among physicians as well as the public at large. And I think it's important to reflect on the fact that in the mid-1960s, these programs were not popular when they were first enacted in the same way that the Affordable Care Act isn't tremendously popular now, but that could change over time as people begin to reap the benefits. It's important to remember that Medicare and Medicaid are such an important source of revenue for hospitals, physicians, and particularly physicians in some specialties. So Medicaid covers about 4 out of every 10 pregnant women in this country. So OBGYNs rely on Medicaid for as a source of their income. Primary care physicians, pediatricians rely on Medicaid as a source of income. So they've really become deeply intertwined with our healthcare system.
And Edwin, in the beginning, at least, when you talk about Medicare being an important source of revenue for medical professionals and for doctors, it was the whole income issue, the revenue issue, that was at the heart of debate, right?
Well, I think that's true, and what we're seeing now is that Medicaid is the largest form of federal assistance to states, financial assistance to states, and as Julie mentioned, it's also particularly Medicaid's case, a vital financing stream for the nation's safety net. That is, the healthcare providers, hospitals, community health centers, other providers that serve low-income communities, particularly communities of color.
412-246-2002, if you want to join the conversation on Essential Pittsburgh with Edwin Park, who is Vice President for Health Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and Julie Donahue, who is with the University of Pittsburgh Graduate School of Public Health. She is Vice Chair for Research in the Department of Health Policy and Management. Again, the number to join the conversation, 412-246-2002. Let's go to Lisa in South Park. Lisa, you're on Essential Pittsburgh. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I called because this is very personal for me. I've worked for 30 years, and when I lost my job because I started having seizures, I received unemployment, but I lost my health care, and the unemployment was too high to qualify me for Medicaid. ACA was not quite ready yet online. So I had seizures for a year with no health care and no way to get health care because the unemployment was just high enough to disqualify me from Medicaid, but not high enough to pay for the premiums and copays available through ACA. Now, after a year of seizures untreated, I qualify for disability and Medicare, and I'm only 49 years old.
So there's this
big gap between Medicaid and Medicare that ACA doesn't fill, and there are a lot of people like myself, and I'm not a minority except that I'm a female, but there are a lot of people like me who lose their jobs, lose their health care, and don't qualify for Medicaid until they do qualify for Medicare, which by then, now I can't work. Now the seizures ruined my brain to the point where I can't work again. So there's something really missing in there.
Well, I appreciate your sharing this with us, Lisa. Stay on the line, and we'll let our experts address this. And Julie, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I think Lisa's story is all too common. Prior to the ACA, and still even after ACA is implemented, There are tremendous gaps in our healthcare system. So people who have to leave the healthcare workforce potentially because of a serious health problem like Lisa's would have to be disabled and wait 2 years until they're eligible for Medicare. And often before the Affordable Care Act was put into place, their incomes might still be too high to qualify them for Medicaid, unless, of course, they met one of these other criteria. Now, with the expansion of the Affordable Care Act, which only began about 7 months ago in Pennsylvania, we're starting to see people come in. We've had about 150,000 Pennsylvanians enroll in the Medicaid program who are newly eligible under these new rules in the Affordable Care Act.
And I was going to ask the question of how has the Affordable Care Act impacted Medicaid, but Lisa, your story clearly illustrates that. So where do you go from here?
Well, myself, I'm still in a dilemma. I'm feeling better. I have Medicaid. Because I got the Medicaid, I qualified. I'm feeling better on the medication. The treatment is a long time. If I do go back to work, I will become disqualified for the Medicaid and the Medicare. So, and then I'll lose the medication and, you know, back to the same cycle.
It's a big catch-22. Edwin, what about this? How illustrative is Lisa's story about where these gaps are and how they need to be filled in?
Sure. I mean, one of the things the Affordable Care Act did was deal with these transitions and avoid and fill these gaps in coverage. So one thing, Lisa, that you can consider is that if you are able to go, you know, back to work and your income goes up, that you would be able to be eligible for help with premiums and cost sharing through the health insurance marketplaces. So if, you know, you're no longer eligible for Medicare on the basis of disability, you may have income too high to qualify for Medicaid under the Medicaid expansion in Pennsylvania, then you would also be now eligible for marketplace subsidies. And I think one of the things that we've seen before the Affordable Care Act is that if people earn too much, they became ineligible for Medicaid, but they may end up in a job that either didn't offer health insurance through the job or that coverage wasn't affordable. And the Affordable Care Act is an attempt to fill those gaps and avoid people falling through the cracks as their life circumstances change.
This was supposed to be Medicaid, Medicare. This was supposed to be the first step towards single-payer health care, but we're nowhere near that now. What has happened over the last 50 years in terms of advancing health care toward the system that many people want, which is single-payer? Has it helped us get any closer to that?
Well, I think that in the near future, there's no doubt that what we're going to continue having is a bit of a patchwork system: Medicare, Medicaid, healthcare marketplaces, employment-based coverage. If you remember, in 1965, many people had coverage through their employer, and so Medicare and Medicaid were trying to fill in the gaps. Now, some of the architects of that legislation in the 1960s saw it as a step toward single payer, whereas others saw it as, we're just going to offer protection to the most vulnerable populations left out of the employment-based system. And I think, you know, no politician really wants to disrupt coverage for 150 million Americans who have it through their employer. So it's pretty difficult to tackle that issue politically.
Edwin, we have Obamacare now. Are we any closer to that?
I think that, you know, as Julie mentioned, I think all of, you know, the opposition to the Affordable Care Act, the talk about disruption to people who are already enrolled in the individual market, I think that's a significant concern and one of the reasons why we haven't moved to single payer. I think, on the other hand, what we've shown through both Medicare and Medicaid in the 50 years since they were enacted into law is that they've done better than the private insurance system in keeping costs down, growing more slowly on a per beneficiary basis, than the private insurance. And in the case of Medicare, being a leader in coming up with innovative ways to control costs, whether in prospective payments for how hospitals are reimbursed for people going to, for a hospital stay, and so forth. And so, you know, I think they do signal that public programs work. They're successful, they can deliver care efficiently, and they can make substantial gains in health coverage. Just since the Affordable Care was enacted, we've seen 16.4 million people are estimated to have gained coverage since the Affordable Care Act was enacted in 2010. Those gains are expected to increase and eventually reach a gain of almost 25 million people who would otherwise have been uninsured having health care coverage.
Let's take a call from Tom in downtown Pittsburgh. Tom, welcome.
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me on. Talking about Medicaid, that was exactly my question. But I'm a physician trained in New England, just got back into the area, and specifically the expansion of Medicaid, especially in Obamacare, which I think is generally a good effort, but I have concerns specifically that Medicaid, as you touched on, doesn't reimburse nearly as competitively as other products, also not as nearly well as Medicare. And as more and more people are introduced to the healthcare pool under the service, that generates a strain on healthcare providers, whether that be physicians or nurses or larger hospital institutions that become reliant on, in some cases, reimbursement from the state for taking care of these people. It is, you could look at it as, oh, well, it's a good cost control measure, but or you could look at it as, an unrealistic expectation. These people, the lights still need to go on in the clinics. You have to see twice as many people in the same amount of time, and it just puts a strain on the providers that I have seen, and it affects where providers want to go. Specifically in Vermont, which isn't necessarily Medicaid, they have a state program, but you saw a efflux of physicians that simply could no longer stay in practice. Everyone is covered, but if there are no physicians or any care providers that can't sustain the infrastructure and salaries to take care of them, then you get sort of healthcare deserts, so to speak. And is this expanding role of Medicaid going to exacerbate that, is everyone just going to have to adapt?
You have concerns about Medicaid being an unfunded mandate and how it stresses the healthcare industry, and it's good to have a physician's perspective on this. It sounds like you said you were in New England, you were in Vermont?
Just across the border in Vermont, at a major medical center, we ended up taking care of a great number of people just across the state.
Well, Julie and Edwin, what about what Tom is saying?
So I think this is a really important issue about how we're reimbursing providers. Medicaid has historically paid much less than private payers or even Medicare to providers for the services, to physicians for the services they provide. And in some ways, in some cases, that hasn't affected physicians' willingness to accept Medicaid patients. But in many areas, particularly subspecialties, psychiatry, physicians are saying, look, I can't cover my costs if I see Medicaid patients. I simply can't accept this as a form of insurance. And that obviously has important consequences for access to care. So I think what Medicaid programs around the country are struggling with is how to contain costs without simply cutting reimbursement rates to providers. How do we extract more efficiency from the system? But in the long run, we can't rely just on cutting provider payment rates.
And the Affordable Care Act included a provision, albeit a temporary one, that increased payment rates physicians who are providing primary care up to the Medicare rates, which in many states was higher. Unfortunately, it was only a two-year provision. It's expired. Both advocates for Medicaid as well as many physician groups are in support of extending it. Unfortunately, it hasn't moved in Congress to have that program continue, but there was some evidence that it did improve participation, particularly as states took up the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. So I think it, as Julie mentioned, it's a critical issue to ensure that reimbursement rates are sufficient to ensure adequate participation by providers, not just physicians, but other providers as well, which in turn ensures that people who are on Medicaid can access the services they need. You know, right now there's no federal requirements on what is a minimum payment rate. It's not set by the federal government like in the Medicare program. So states do need to look at their provider rates and make sure that it's promoting adequate participation, that there's sufficiently large provider networks so that people throughout a state who are on Medicaid have access.
We've been looking at the 50th anniversary of the enactment of Medicaid, Medicare, signed into law by President Johnson on this date 50 years ago, July 30th, 1965. Our guests have been Julie Donahue, who is Vice Chair for Research in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the University of Pittsburgh, and Edwin Park, Vice President for Health Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us today and sharing your insights on Essential Pittsburgh. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, Paul.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Coming up, contributor Elaine LaBalme has part two of her list of can't-miss dining destinations for the savvy traveler, and later, a conversation with Riverhounds goalie and Gold Cup soccer hero Ryan Thompson. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.